in. Can you guys hear me? All right, can everyone to grab a seat as soon as you get a chance, and we're going to get started. You know, people are still trickling in. We've got a lot of information to share with you guys tonight. So welcome. First off, my name is Kim Rolla. I'm a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center. I'm going to start off actually by introducing some other folks. My co-presenter, Dr. Bill Harris. Let me try to close this mic. So, as a brief aside, the first email I ever sent to Dr. Harris, I was asking him probably something about the FAR Advisory Council. I sent him a very formal email, dear Dr. Harris, blah, 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 best, Kim, and he responded, Kim, there are no titles in the struggle for social justice. So, much to Instagram, I'm going to read you about Bill's fancy titles right now. Bill is a retired professor of urban studies and planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Martin Luther King Visiting Professorship. He is formerly a professor and associate dean at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, School of Policy and Planning, College of Public Service at Jackson State University. He has taught at Virginia State University, the University of Virginia, Cornell University, and Georgia Regents University. He was the first African-American in the United States to earn a doctorate in urban planning and the first African-American elected to the College of Fellows of the American Institute of Certified Planners. So we have a true expert with us tonight. And as I mentioned, my name is Kim Rolla. I'm the Housing Team Coordinator at Legal Aid Justice Center. I'm here because I work really closely with a number of resident associations within the strategic investment area, the area that the form-based code is proposed to apply to. So I'm really here as an outgrowth of trying to help those residents' associations understand the form-based code. And last but not least, on stage with us here, we have Tex Pasley, who is a law student at the University of Virginia. He's a student in the Litigation Housing Clinic at the Legal Aid Justice Center, and he has become quite the expert in form-based code. And I'm actually going to transition my thank yous by thanking Tex for all the hard work he's done to help make this presentation happen. We'd also like to thank the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center for hosting this event and for co-sponsoring it. We'd also like to thank our other sponsors, the NAACP, the Public Housing Association of Residents, Standing Up for Women's Justice in Charlottesville, and we'd also like to thank Walt Heineke, who provided your food this evening. So if you see him, say thanks. And thank Walt again and Ms. Alilia Henry, who's right there, for helping us with logistical support and spreading the word about the event this evening. So thank you, everyone, for helping make this happen. And we already did our introductions, but just to frame you guys this evening, the goal of why... Can everyone see? Okay. The goal of why we're here this evening... Number one, we want to convince the community that this is an important issue. We're really heartened that there are this many people here to talk about zoning. That's fabulous. And the second reason we're here is we want to give you the tools to participate in a conversation about the future of the city zoning. None of us are experts in all things. Like I said, I'm not a planner. Neither Bill nor I nor Tech live in the strategic investment area. We all have different expertise to offer, so we're not here to really give answers. We're here to share information to enable you all to participate in this process. That's our goal for today. So, again, we hope that this is a continued community conversation, but we are going to ask folks, if possible, to hold your questions to the end. If you need a clarification if something we're saying doesn't make sense, by all means, put your hands up. But as far as commentary or expressing opinions, we're really going to ask folks to hold that to the end because we have a lot to get through. That'll be really helpful for us. So, what we're going to talk about today, I'm going to start you off with some Charlottesville context. Why are we here? Why is this event called Gentrification, Zoning, and Form-Based Code? Bill is going to come up and give you an introduction to zoning and land use. And then I'll come back and zoom in a little bit closer again on gentrification and form-based code. What are each of those concepts? How are they related, if they are related? And then finally, we're going to talk about briefly about a toolbox. What can the locality do to preserve affordable housing and to stop any gentrification that is occurring in the city? So let's start off with our Charlottesville context, just to frame this conversation. So, the form-based code we're going to be discussing tonight, it's site-specific. It's proposed to apply in something called the strategic investment area. Strategic investment area is a certain part of the city. It was identified in an appendix to the city's comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan for cities, it's a statement of their goals, their objectives, principles, guidelines, standards for growth and development of the community. So the, as the slide says, this strategic investment area was adopted by city council as an appendix to their comprehensive plan in February of 2014. And I'm just going to, there's an excerpt there, but I want to read you what the city itself said the purpose of the strategic investment area was. To initiate a transformational process to engage stakeholders, city staff, members of the greater community in the future of the strategic investment area. The plan is to provide guidance for future redevelopment and investment in the area. Improvements to affordable housing, including existing public housing, public and assisted housing, improve connections throughout the area, and recommend strategies for expanding employment opportunities throughout the SIA. So actually, really quickly, let's just look at the SIA. So this is the area south of the downtown mall. I think I actually have a laser pointer. I do. Okay. So the shaded areas in here are subsidized housing. There are three large Charlottesville Redevelopment Housing Authority properties there, public housing, and also Friendship Court. So if you're disoriented here, here's, I get very disoriented looking at these maps, I'll turn different ways, but this is Friendship Court, right here. This is the Community Bikes, the Avon Street Garage, and over here we've got 6th Street, Crescent Hall, and South 1st Street. Those are public housing properties. So that's a lot of the city's public housing is in this area. So this gives you an idea of where, and this is also encompassing some of Belmont, we've got over by Martha Jefferson, a little tiny bit of Fifeville. So it's a really diverse area of the city. So again, turning to the purpose, the summation kind of what the city is saying, if they want to take this area and make it mixed income, mixed use, without displacement. Okay, so they want to take mixed use means both residential and business in this area, mixed income as it sounds, people of different income brackets all living together in this space. This is a massive document. I'm not going to try to explain strategic investment area to you, first and foremost, because I'm not sure that I know what 271 of those pages say. But this document was created with input from the community, though there was a public input process, I will say. People feel differently about how all stakeholder views are reflected in that, but if you have more interest in the strategic investment area, I suggest you take a look at the document. It's available on the city's website. The last thing I wanted to mention, obviously this event starts with the word gentrification. There are some statistics about the strategic investment area in the past decade and a half that suggest its demographics are changing. Obviously this is before any form-based code, right? These are, this is occurring in the market already. From 2000 to 2012, the percentage of black residents in that area I just showed you went from 51% to 38%. And to put some hard numbers on that, that means that 180 black residents left that area. And the white residents of that area went from 45% to 54%, meaning that 429 white people moved into that area between 2000 and 2012. During that same time period, the average household income went approximately from $30,000 to $40,000. And we're going to describe in more detail what exactly gentrification is, but as a teaser, that might be something right there. Okay, so I did really quickly just want to talk about, so when we say we're going to create mixed income areas, we're going to redevelop and renovate an area without displacement, what that usually means, we're going to move more people in there, right? Increase density. We'll talk more about these terms, but it means without getting rid of the folks that are already there, you're going to put some more people in that same space. So the SIA also identifies where priority infill areas may be. That means where they think they may put more people on top of the folks that are already there. If you can see the perhaps correlation there, those are the infill properties. The dark red are the primary infill. Secondary infill are the light red. So we got some correlation going on with where our subsidized properties are now. Turning now to form-based code in particular, why are we talking about the form-based code in the strategic investment area? The strategic investment area identifies form-based code as one of its catalyst projects. There's a whole list of Catalyst projects. These are things, on page 107, if you're following along in your strategic investment area plan. These are things that they would have liked to have been completed within a year of the strategic investment area plan being adopted. That's obviously, we're past that year, but these are priority things they want to be done. The form-based code was included on that list as a tool to implement the recommendations of the strategic investment area. So we're not going to go through all of them, but the code is a way to actually get developers and builders to put into place what the plan would like to see, right? The form-based code is a tool. The form-based code for the strategic investment area, they anticipate it being rolled out in three phases. And again, I would go back to our subsidized property and infill areas. Phase one is where you see that, a lot of it is where you see that dark red and where you see Friendship Court. I think that 6th Street's also included, but it's right in this central area is where they're going to do phase one of the form-based code. The RFP, which is a request for proposals for form-based code, that's when the city asks consultants to apply to fulfill a contract, it's already out. You can find that too on the city's website. The city's already put it out, asking for consultants to submit their proposals. The RFP says that the form-based code must be completed, it must be written within 12 months of the contract being signed. I say that to frame already why we think it's so fabulous that there's so many of you here tonight. This is a conversation that needs to start happening right now. These proposals are going to be submitted really, really soon. Another thing I want to flag at the very beginning as context for this conversation is that the RFP only requires in those proposals two public meetings. And to get drilled even further, one of those public meetings is for city officials, right? It's for city council, it's for the planners. Only one must be for resident stakeholders. That's a really big deal. Of course, they could submit a proposal for more meetings, but this is another reason why we need to be proactive about getting the community involved in this conversation. So with all of that context, to be a little bit positive as I hand the mic to Bill, the city itself has said that the SIA plan is a guide. It is not a prescriptive document meant to be followed to the letter. The implementation depends on feedback from the public, especially owners in the study area. And that's why we're here talking with you tonight. We want to encourage you to be involved in this process, and like I said, our goal tonight is not to dictate answers, but to provide tools to everyone here this evening to participate in this public discussion the city is referring to.
Thank you, Kim. And one nice thing about having an attorney to introduce you, they tell lies just as you're right. All right. I'm a professional planner. And as a professional planner, I have real commitment to serving all of the people in the community. And I want you to take a look at this pledge. Both of the major planners in the city of Charlottesville are what we call AICP. They took an exam, they passed it, and they are supposed to have a commitment, aspirational commitment, as I have presented here for you. Now, this statement is very, very clear. Number one, you're expected as a professional planner, you're expected to achieve or at least seek social justice. And in doing so, the part that is most of interest to me, responsibility to plan for the needs of the disadvantaged and provide racial and economic integration. SIE doesn't do that, for example. We, speaking as professional planners, we shall urge the alteration of policies, institutions, and decisions that oppose such needs. So you see, city planners are in violation of what our professional code of ethics expects of them. In fact, they are the guys who now are providing the stimulation for bringing about programs such as SIA. The American Planning Association and its professional planners are clear on this topic. And remember, even if the city council wants something different, as planners, we were expected what? We urge the alteration of policies. Do something different. Because our first commitment is to the disadvantaged, how black and other people of color, especially the poor. Now, I offer this for two reasons. One, I want the public to know it. The second is, when you have planners who are not delivering the way they should, you should contact the American Planning Association and let them know that. Now, there's nothing gentle about community development. That's why I lose more battles than I ever win. But my stimulation for continuing is losing. I know I don't have the money. I don't have the resources to bring money. I know I don't have the numbers. I know I don't always have the most high-paying professional staff that the city or the county has. But my obligation as a professional planner is to serve the interests of these people who are disadvantaged. And even if a program comes through that is in opposition to my obligation, I should work to bring about alterations to it. Tim, I think I've screwed it up. This is the first time I've had the opportunity to speak to such a large crowd on zoning. I've talked for 40 years. If there were one topic that the students want to ace and get out, it's zoning. So thank you, guys. Now, zoning is a law. And we're going to come back to that. But zoning is a law. It is important. It is one that is sanctioned by the police power. So you see, it comes all the way down from the U.S. Constitution. In 1926, zoning became a nationally accepted legal law franchise. In 1926, the U.S. Supreme Court said, look, local communities, under the powers of the police powers, local communities have every right to regulate land use. Now, that's not a simple matter in this country. We like to think in America, what? If it's my land, if it's my property, by God, I'll do with it as I please. That's just not the case. Not since 1926 do you have the right, R-I-G-H-T, the right to do with your property whatever you please. You may live within the constraints of a local community's zoning law. Now, zoning, not exclusively, but zoning primarily is used to specify land use. The oversimplified presentation on that is that, well, it's always correlated to special uses, certain kinds of uses here, certain kinds of uses there, certain kinds of uses elsewhere. Well, that's an oversimplification. Zoning goes much beyond that. For example, for those of you who like sexy bookstores, well, zoning can regulate those things. Getting your business, but zoning goes all the way around. It deals with morals, it deals with land use, and it deals in a great way to something called density, how many people we're going to permit in an area. In fact, in the city of Charlottesville, home ownership occupants 44%. Only 44%. Statewide, it's 66%. And what does that say to you? That says people who own property in Charlottesville rent it out to students. So the monster comes from what? The grounds. Once there was a planner here who would always argue it's like having an elephant in the room. Well, I'll open an elephant. But when you've got 18,000 students all looking for some place to live, the own grounds are off, and most of them are.
than the pressure that is placed upon citizens who cannot afford to buy these expensive properties become very, very challenging. Now, we say in zoning that it seeks to ensure the highest and best use. Let's show you how things have changed. The highest and best use initially, coming out of 1926, was the protection of a single family home. Well, zoning has come a long way, I want to tell you, because so much of highest and best use these days is economic development. Now, part of that has to do with the fact that if we don't have economic development, we don't have a city very long. And what are some of the consequences of zoning? And I'm not going to give up the set of opportunities here. In almost every case in the United States of America, zoning has been the primary tool used for racial segregation. It means no difference whether you're in the South or whether you're in the North, East, or West. A little less intense in the West, but racial segregation is a primary contribution of zoning. Now, why? We can play all the word games we want. It comes down to the fact that white people don't want to live near black people. All right? Therein lies the issue. You aren't going to find large numbers of white folks coming up saying, no. This segregation ain't going to cut it. We want some fairness. So since white people do not, in the main, he said my citizens, some white person says, I can't get somebody to black. No, get away from me. The issue becomes one then, zoning has been a perfect tool for bringing about racial segregation by race and income. Now, performance zoning, this is one I've always talked to. In performance zoning, and I must say, in Virginia, in Massachusetts, some of the other states that have the Dillon rule, some of this performance zoning becomes not very easy to bring about. But performance zoning provides flexibility, rationality, transparency, and accountability. See, there's really no need for form-based codes if we would exercise performance zoning. I'm going to just in this comment get into Ken's presentation. Form-based codes are designed to make it, in a nutshell, to make it easy for developers to do things by right. Cuts out the middleman, i.e. the local community, almost exclusively. Incentive zoning. Now, in incentive zoning, the developer actually gets a reward that allows the company or the developer to get some interest in what he wants. Now, incentive zoning generally comes up with the following kind of things. The city may say, or the county may say, all right, fine. We'll allow you to put in for 800 units. Yeah, that was a little trouble. You put in for 100 units, and it's all going to be upscale. Well, I'll tell you what, for incentive zoning. I'll let you go with 120 if you put 20% of the housing for low income. So the reward is you get greater use of your property, but the constraint comes around and not permitting you to do as you really wishes to, but in fact, the city will work with you through incentive zoning to bring about trying to spread the good much more widely. Kim, I'm going to leave for form-based codes. I've already made my point on that, and we'll come back to it. Now, zoning is a law, and I want to make this one clear because planning commission is frequently, I served on the planning commission show for 8 years, and I don't know how that ever happened. I think it's because Eugene Williams was my advocate, because David Toscano, those crews, never really have supported my being on the planning commission. But I want to share with you what is law, such as zoning, and what is a tool of zoning. For example, we all are aware, these developers are, of subdivision
regulations.
In subdivision regulations, what you agree to do, the developer
has a system of
how to put some roads in, how to build the homes and all of that, or factories, whatever it is. But so in that subdivision, I'm going to have a major responsibility for its implementation. That's not zoning. That is a tool that is used in zoning. Housing codes. Every city, county needs housing codes. Otherwise, the property runs the risk, at least, of deteriorating. And in having housing codes, there are very specific kinds of requirements that every house must have to meet the standard for the code. That's not zoning. That is a tool used in zoning. Plan unit developments is pretty much the same thing as subdivision regulations, do a little different. A PUD, plan unit development, is primarily an exercise on the part of the developer to take on a fair amount of responsibility for bringing into fruition his her or their plans for development. Now, one I do like, and is never used in Virginia to my knowledge, is transfer development rights. And transfer development rights, let's say the developer has 100 acres, not talking about Charlesburg here, 100 acres available for development. The local government says, no, we aren't going to let you develop on with that level of intensity on that 100 acres. So the developer said, why? Because the city or the county says, well, because we want to use that land for something else. And the developer says, I'll tell you what, I own 200 acres out west of Charlottesville, Lincoln County, or wherever it is. And if you swap those 200 acres that I have outside of the city and permit me to build as I wish on the 100 acres that I have in the city, then that's called transfer development rights. I think it's an excellent idea. It's very difficult to bring about because generally you're going to have developers with more land than they're typically trying to implement on a site-specific basis. Now, capital improvement program, that's the budget. That's the budget generally in most cities and counties. The capital improvement program is not zoning, but it is a tool that's used. Capital improvement programs are the budget for streets, roads, school repair, and school construction, for that matter, if they're worried. But it's your plan for the next 5 or 10 years that allows for a fairly intense ability to set money aside, and maybe sometimes bonding is required, but have sufficient resources to bring about the repair and construction of public facilities. Now, oh, I got this one for you. Yeah. I got to share this with you, even though it's form-based codes. Form-based codes come out of something called New Urbanism. It's just a hot idea that some very rich developers came about, and the single best example of the meanness of New Urbanism is Riverside. It's a development in Florida. Now, this is what the form-based codes do. There are some advantages. For example, granite flats for the poor. Now, you know where those granite flats typically are? One or two rooms above the garage. And you know why the poor are there? Because they clean their houses, so these dead people are too lazy to take care of themselves. Cheap labor. Almost always what comes, because the projects, the programs, are really very substantial in scale. And so if you want people to do the day-to-day charwoman, charman work, you can get them cheap. Therein lies one attractive feature. Now, the physical attractiveness, the aesthetics, are generally very, very nice. Very nice. Everybody wants to live there where few can afford. Greater ease for development. In form-based codes, developers love it. It's always the developer, by the way. That's what Paul's doing with Charlottesville. These planners rushed out themselves to bring it about. They don't have to. The developers come and say, look, we don't want any interference from government. And that's what the form-based code does. It said, we want to develop by right and don't want you to interfere. Now, the only reason a community would go for that is for economic development purposes. Now, what are some of the disadvantages? In almost every case, you have a displacement to the outer fringe of the poor. We send them further out. If you look for a place such as Washington, D.C., I remember when I was an undergraduate student in Washington, D.C., Silver Springs, man, was hot stuff. The truck would roll up, I'd have to run in and hand up the package and get back in the truck quickly because it was clearly I ain't had no business being in that white community. Well, now it's a radically different place. And that's where even in Washington, D.C., the poor are being forced out to those suburbs. Let me ask you, how does one know when gentrified areas are about? There's one particular guy. I'm going to tell you. You want to know if an area is gentrified, and it used to be black, go through that area just at dusk, and if you see a white woman pushing her baby in a stroller, it's gentrified. Alright? Because what comes about, the city is not going to have those white women in any danger, right? They are the highest of all forms of human life in our society. So there's no way you're not going to have plenty, plenty cops. I saw it in Pruitt, Idaho, the area now that is gone. I saw it also in Washington, D.C. I see it in my hometown, Richmond, in Churchill. White woman is pushing her baby in a stroller and is getting near dust, no problem. All right? That's how you know. Another fallout of form-based codes is lack of employment advancement. You will not find in a very upscale development very many people of color, and certainly the poor, who are going to be on some track of continuing their progress economically, job-wise. Now, I know that is frightening to some of you, but I don't care how liberal or progressive you are, that's a fact. We just don't get the damn jobs that you like in your mind to think we do. We don't. And also, there's always social and economic segregation. We're certainly not surprised by that. The primary cancer of America is racism. And the primary impact of racism is segregation, economically and racially. Some people would say, well, I feel okay living around white people. Some people say, I feel okay living around some blacks. Well, they're lying, or they're just ignorant. Because, in fact, they don't want to live around. Look at the hill, look at Ridge Street. I'm bringing it right home now, okay? All of that. I first came to Charlottesville when my brother was an undergraduate student at UVA in 1960. That was a hell of a time, too. But all along West Main Street were the Inches and other people who had stores. Vinegar Hill was still, to some degree, thriving with black-owned businesses. Well, that's all gone. Now, you may say, well, that's the private sector. We've always got some rationalization. That's one of the wonderful things about being a human being. You can cheat, lie, cheat, and steal, and rationalize. And what it does bring up, lastly, here is racial tensions. For people who think that somehow racial segregation, economic and
racial holds no potential for difficulties down the road.
Yes, say it in this picture.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay. We're going to do some more detailed definitions of what exactly we mean when we say form-based code. We're going to do the same for gentrification, and then I see a lot of people that are making faces, shifting their seats, wanting to talk. So we're going to talk about what, is there any relationship between these two terms, and if so, what is it? Okay, so we're going to get detailed. There's some general defining characteristics of form-based code. Form-based code is being instituted locally, right? So there's not one form-based code that cities are adopting, right? So these are, when people say form-based code, let's talk about what general characteristics that would include. The kind of zoning we have now in Charlottesville, I don't know if you mentioned, it's called Euclidean zoning. It's named after the Supreme Court case in 1926 that Bill mentioned that said that zoning was legal. Someone's cell phone was talking. So developers, as Bill said, they were upset about this. There was their private property. The idea that the community could tell a private developer what to do with their land was pretty wild. So they went to the Supreme Court and they confirmed with the police powers for health, morals, and safety that you could zone. And the zoning, traditional zoning, Euclidean zoning, is for use. So single-family residential, multifamily, commercial. They're saying what exactly the development on that property is going to do. Form-based code, instead of that, it's form. So the word form means design, right? So the idea that it's more aesthetically motivated. In Charlottesville, they decided to go forward with something called transects. I won't try to go into super detail here, but basically the idea that your transects go all the way from T1 to T9, is that right, developers? All the way from rural to urban core, right? So to natural, to rural, to suburban, to outer urban ring, and each of those is going to have a different level of like density and height. Really, we're talking about what the buildings look like to make sure everything is integrated. And we'll go into more detail about what motivates that in a minute. The first feature, design-based, not use-based. Second, instead of being planner-driven, there's a word that I have learned that planners love, and it's called charrettes. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. It's basically community meeting. So the idea being, the way they style form-based code is that form-based code, the code is just a bucket, and we're going to fill it with what the community wants, right? We're going to have meetings where people are going to define what the form-based code should be for in our neighborhood, right? So this is the idea that it's going to be written by the public. And because of that, tied to that is this idea of it being simplified. As an example, Nashville adopted a form-based code. Their code was over 100 pages. It went down to about 5. The idea being that if lay people that aren't planners, like me or like you, write a code, we're not going to have 100 pages worth of words to use. We're going to make it more accessible, right? So the idea being that it's simplified. We're going to go through and talk about pros and cons of all this in a minute. The third, and Bill mentioned this as well, like prescriptive, the idea that it wants to encourage what's called of-right development. If you follow the code, it should be approved. It's going to minimize, we'll talk more in a minute about special use permits, the idea of going through a public process to ask for special permission to do things. We're going to minimize that because we're going to write rules, and if you follow the rules, your property's approved. That's actually reflected in the strategic investment area. Another one of their, remember the term, catalyst projects is expedited staff review. It's what it's referring to, right? So whereas now you may have meetings before the board of architects review or something like that, we're going to minimize, the goal is to minimize that under the form-based code to get things done as quickly as possible if you follow the rules. So those are the general defining characteristics, and I think as Bill did, it's really useful to pull back and think of form-based code as a tool. It's a tool of new urbanism, which the most basic way I can describe it, it's mixed-use, densely populated, pedestrian-friendly neighborhoods, right? So we're talking about you want people to be able to walk from where they live to where they work to where they eat, this idealized version of what the early 20th century city was like. And I think, when you may be sensing some anxiety or skepticism up here about some aspects of new urbanism, and I think that comes from asking, who will our new cities be built for, right? We hear about the suburbanization of poverty, which I think is what Bill was talking a little bit about, of seeing in the outer rings now, of people being pushed as wealthy and more affluent folks, tend to be white folks, pull back into cities. What happens to the poor people that live there now? They're moving to the cities after white flight. So this is and that's not to say form-based code causes that, but we all exist in a context, and form-based code exists in that context. You can't remove it from that. So that's a good transition to asking, what exactly is gentrification? That is a very contentious question. So I'm going to do the faux pas of a presenter, and I'm going to redo the dictionary definition. The process of renewal and rebuilding accompanying the influx of middle class or affluent people into deteriorating areas that often, not always, displaces poor people. I would flag for folks that I think that there's other issues of gentrification people frequently raise. The resident association I work with, there's concern about cohesiveness of neighborhoods, of the character of neighborhoods. For example, what amenities are available in an area? Are those businesses, the people that lived there before and they used, are they still going to be there if you put 200 market rate units on top of them? Right? So there's more than just displacement happening there. It's about people's communities. And when we talk about displacement, I think everyone kind of intuitively has a sense of this, but what are the mechanisms of displacement for gentrification? If wealthy people are moving into an area, it's going to be worth more. If you're a renter, your rent will go up. If you are a homeowner, your property taxes will go up. Both of those can mean that people who lived there before can no longer afford to live there. Okay, we're going to talk about that in more detail in a minute, but those are the mechanisms of displacement. And so bear with me for just a moment. I think this is interesting. I may just be a nerd, but I want to flag for you guys, if you haven't noticed yet, zoning is, there's an inherent tension, right? The idea that zoning is both communitarian and elitist. I mean, those are big words, but basically the idea that the fact that we can democratically tell you what to do with your private property and it may not be what's the highest dollar value for you, that's kind of radical in the U.S. That was a big deal in the 20s. People were very upset about it. It's also really elitist. Like Bill said, zoning has been used for terrible things in this country. Actually, when I was researching for this presentation, until 1917 in this country, you could explicitly zone a block as black or white, right? And we explicitly racially zone things. The way cities look now, there are still the vestiges of that legalized segregation in our cities. And then once they made that illegal, they made it less explicit, right? Zone for single family use. Well, who can afford a single family home? Or, right, let's go into more detail. It's zoned for single family use and your lot has to be, I don't know, big. And your home's got to be big, right? Who's going to be able to afford that? So, Since zoning is kind of dry, while I was online, I found this group called YIMBY, which is yes, in my backyard, rather than no, not in my backyard. So they made this campaign called Neighbors for More Neighbors that talks about some of the exclusion, that kind of makes fun of some of the ways we use zoning to keep people out of neighborhoods. So this is a couple sitting. She says, he said he was for affordable housing, and he wanted to downzone my block. So we're going to learn this term. We'll learn it and we'll discuss later. Downzoning is when you take, let's say it was zoned for multifamily, and you say, no, now only single family homes can be built here, right? What does that mean? Who gets pushed out when you do that? Here's a nice innocuous gay white couple. They seem like they'd be pro affordable housing, right? So he says, you can't always tell if he believes in single family zoning. If he mentions neighborhood character, it's time to talk about zoning. He starts to gripe about renters not contributing to the neighborhood, it's time to talk about zoning. Okay, so now that we know that zoning can be good or bad, right? Let's talk about some of the bad things that can happen. This is the million-dollar question everyone's here for tonight, probably on both sides of. Is form-based code, is it related to gentrification? And if so, how? I'm going to do my best to represent both sides of these questions, and here are issues that I think are important in making that assessment. Form-based code can accelerate development and growth. That's part of the reason the city wants to do it. They want to increase property tax revenue. It's inherent in redeveloping an area, right? And it's also, when you increase as-of-right development, it can make things go faster. That's one of the facets of form-based code. And in discussing this, I kind of want to go through, like I said, form-based code can look different in different areas. So let's talk about some places that have done it. Let's talk about Nashville. And disclaimer, right? Nashville is the hottest rental market. It's the hottest housing market in the country, right? It's really, Nashville is booming. So it's not the form-based code did this, but Nashville, as I mentioned, they adopted a form-based code. And with some statistics from 2011 to 2012, their average home price has gone from $167,500 to $266,408. Monthly rent in Nashville has gone from $872 to $1,396. And that's in 4 years. Right? So it's hard to play the causation game. I'm not going to try to, but I will say that I think that lots of smart folks have argued that form-based code can accelerate development. As Bill mentioned, there's decreased public process, that expedited staff review we talked about. I'll start with the pro here, so you don't think I'm being too negative. It can be a NIMBY block, right? I think actually less process and less opportunity for the public to speak. Depends on who's speaking, whether that's like good for affordable housing or not, right? If there's people that are going to object to any multifamily property being built, you know, maybe you want to give them less opportunities to stand on the stump and do that. A case study for this that I think is really interesting is New Orleans. They decided to adopt neighborhood-based form-based codes after Katrina. So I don't think I need to explain the context of that, right? But Katrina devastated New Orleans. A lot of folks that left, particularly low-income and Black folks, weren't able to come back. And the areas that were hardest hit, a lot of them were low-lying areas that had high percentages of African Americans living there, and they flooded the worst. When they did this, and I think it's an interesting case study because when you do form-based codes, you lose some of the citywide democratic ability to talk in a broader context, right? So now each of these neighborhoods is designing their code for what they want things to look like rather than having that citywide conversation about what kind of environmental protections or infrastructure that we need to make the entire city safe, right? So I guess big point here, the form-based codes can be used to decrease public process. And to be fair, right, that's because they're going to say they already had detailed community input, right? We talked about the SHREC. The whole thing is driven by the community. You're filling the box. You wrote the code. So, you know, we should be comfortable with moving faster now. One of the common questions in the literature is, who's participating in the stress and who controls the outcome? Basically, the idea being that, my apologies to planners, that planners are not sensitive to power dynamics sometimes. That there may be elite groups that are able to control the stress process, that whose reviews are more thoroughly reflected in the outcome, and those tend to be elites with education, money, and experience and formal processes. So I would note, again, to play devil's advocate and argue with myself, you know, we lamented the loss of public process. Well, wouldn't that be true in Euclidean zoning meetings, right? Like, if you were having the public process now, wouldn't the same elites control those meetings? I don't know. I do think that that's one of the common questions that's asked about the SHREC process. Fourth is downzoning, and I'll actually reference the case study here, give credit to Free Enterprise Forum, which is a group of developers here in Charlottesville. And they've expressed concern that change in zoning is always an opportunity to downzone, which you learned the term from that cute YIMBY advertisement, right? That they could take what people could build now and make it smaller in certain areas. Say you can't build the building as high as we used to say you're able to build it, or you can't have as many people live there. I think that, again, all of these are context specific about whether that's good or bad, and I think the important question to ask is who gets downzoned and why. When we look at those maps, which neighborhoods can have less multifamily properties built there? Where are the buildings smaller? Who's getting 400 units built on top of them, right? I mean, those are the questions to ask. And the last that I would flag about in this city, in Virginia as well, as far as form-based code and gentrification, is the interaction with our city's affordable housing ordinance. Right now, I think probably some folks in the audience are familiar, but the city has a program where if you want special permission to do something with your development, I want to build an 8-story building instead of 6, and I'm going to ask the city for special permission. And in exchange for that permission, they're going to give me, I'm going to agree to build 15% affordable units on that property, or build them somewhere else, or pay into the affordable housing fund, right? So it's a carrot that I offer the city. If you give me special privileges, if you say I don't have to have as many parking spots as I'm supposed to, or whatever it is, then they can, in exchange, they can ask me to build affordable housing. The reason that this intersects with form-based code is because, remember, one of the goals here is to create as-of-right development. Right? People can, if they follow the rules, they get to build the property. So to the extent we're minimizing those special asks, they don't have to ask for what are called special use permits, they don't have to make proffers to the city, they're not going to get brought into the affordable housing ordinance, right? The city never has that hook to ask them to build affordable housing. Does that make sense? Okay. So I know that's a lot, and again, we're not here to dictate answers, but I do, I think it would be foolish of us to point out, 10,000 potential problems and not show people what we could potentially do to influence this process, to make it better. Again, I just want to remind folks, the SIA is a plan, right? The public can influence this. That's why we're here today. It's not an academic exercise. We really want folks to get involved and influence this. But first, I know this is not a law school lecture, but since we're in Charlottesville, I have to talk about a dead white guy. And we're going to talk about John Forrest Dillon, okay? And the only thing you know about John Forrest Dillon is there's something named after him called the Dillon Rule. We won't go super deep into it because it's not a law class, but the Dillon Rule is a rule of statutory interpretation. It's a rule that tells you what local governments can do, and it's a rule that defines that narrowly. And in Virginia, there's actually Supreme Court authority that says that only the powers that are specifically given to localities by the General Assembly, by our legislature, that's all the localities have. And then any powers that can be necessarily or fairly implied. What you basically need to know is that very narrowly interpreted. If the General Assembly doesn't say that Charlottesville can do it, we can't do it. Okay? So this meeting is assuming that our primary advocacy is going to be to the city, okay? So that's in that context, when GA on here is referencing the General Assembly. So I just want to explain why we're talking about the General Assembly so frequently. One of the primary tools that cities have that Bill mentioned is inclusionary zoning. Inclusionary zoning basically says that you have to build a certain percentage of affordable housing units. In Virginia, there's a specific statute that only applies to certain municipalities. Albemarle County is actually one. Charlottesville is not. That allows for mandatory inclusionary zoning. The best example of this, if you're interested, if you want to geek out, is Fairfax. Fairfax County has a mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinance. If you build over 50 units, you're going to be brought into this ordinance, and their affordable housing ordinance, and they're going to require you to build some affordable housing. In my opinion, best case scenario. Right? Anything that gets built, you're guaranteeing there's going to be a certain percentage of affordable units. Folks that are not under that statute, we have the proffer system, which we discussed in brief a minute ago, and folks seem to get. That's basically our current affordable housing ordinance, where we have to have a hook, right? They have to be asking for something extra when we say, yes, we'll give you permission, but you must build a certain number of affordable housing units. The wrinkle here is that, again, if we're having more upright development, folks aren't going to be brought under that ordinance because we don't have the hook. Arlington recently adopted a form-based code in Columbia Pike, and they kind of baked in their affordable housing requirement into the form-based code. Basically gives that what developers call a density bonus if you build certain affordable housing. So it's not in the special use permit process. It's right in the code. I have GA unclear because after talking to a number of lawyers, we weren't clear whether they could actually do that under the statute. So no one's come after Arlington. I could hypothesize for you about why, and maybe the developers think, if we're going to have to build affordable units, we'd rather forego the whole special use process because it just takes longer and costs us more money. I don't know, but that is an option. I think if when we're talking to if I was at a meeting on form-based code in Charlottesville, I would want to know how they're going to deal with the fact that this ordinance is going to be less useful, and are they going to try to do this? Are they going to try to put that into the form-based code? And if not, how are you going to deal with the fact that we're not going to have the same flow to the affordable housing fund anymore? Another tool is property tax exemptions. General Assembly's already said yes on this. Anyone that's interested, Virginia Code 58.1-3200. Charlottesville actually takes advantage of this. For single family homes worth up to $506,000. $506,000. It does not allow this for multifamily housing. So this is a provision that allows if you redevelop a property that's 15 years old, the increased value on that property, you can exempt it from property taxes. The state has given us the blessing to use that as a tool to finance the development of multifamily housing. We're just not giving it. And the last one, maybe just for my own edification as a housing attorney, a source of income protection. We have state fair housing laws. We do not protect source of income, which means if you have a voucher, if you have a tenant-based subsidy, if you folks know what vouchers are, if you have a housing choice voucher, if you have something like CRHA pays part of your rent to a private landlord, the landlord can just say, I don't like that, I'm not renting to you. That has been, that's a very real possibility. As neighborhoods change character, the folks that live there are different, landlords may start to do that more. I have GA unclear because, what this state law says is municipalities can't, local governments can't do things that contradict our state fair housing law. Not clear whether that means you try to narrow it or expanding, it's also not okay. You guys remember when universities added LGBTQ protection to a lot of their codes and the attorney general made some noise about that? I don't know if anyone followed that. That was a similar argument, right? Can you expand protections if the state says no? I don't know. And the second question is, would the state even go after you, right? So these are the kinds of questions, again, we're not here to provide answers to all of these, but these are the kinds of questions I would ask, the kinds of tools I would want to consider having in my toolbox if we were going to go into the zoning code. So since I know that was like nerdy and legal, my too long didn't read slide of my summaries of what we'd like you to take home today is that we need all of you involved now, right? If they go take it back from the very beginning, this process is moving quickly. RFP exists. Once they sign a contract, there's going to be 12 months possibly until we have a form-based code. And as we mentioned as well, the way the form-based codes work, there may be less opportunities for public input later. So we really want folks to get informed. We're learning ourselves right now, and we want to help get this knowledge out into the community and have folks participate now. And then the second is that the city really needs to think about what tools are specifically designed to preserve and expand affordable housing, right? We could argue all day about, and I'm sure our question and answer will be a vigorous argument about whether form-based codes are positive or negative. Regardless, right, unless we make it specifically speak to affordable housing and to low-income folks, it's an aesthetic code, right? We need to talk about the specific tools that are going to make sure that folks of color, that black folks, that poor folks in our communities stay in Charlottesville. And you know what, to be frank, again, we use the word expand intentionally. We do not have enough affordable housing. It's not just about losing it. We need to talk about how the city is going to proactively expand the stock of affordable housing in this country. Country would be very different. And now, Emily is reminding me that we have a very brief sign-on letter that we've drafted, basically, thank you. Not asking any of those specific tools, but just talking about those general principles that we'd like to ask the city to embrace as they move forward with this. They're going around now, so if you take a letter and sign on, if you agree, we really want to show the city that this is important to the broader community. So thanks again for everyone for coming out. This is a truly impressive crowd. And we're going to take some questions now, so please stick around if you can. I don't know if we have a second mic or what's the best way to do if people just want to shout. We can summarize. Oh, I'm sorry. And really quickly before... Emily wants me to read this letter to you. I'm sorry, you're probably tired of me talking. And then we'll take questions. Dear members of City Council, we are concerned about the changes in our neighborhoods and the displacement of long-term, low-income city residents. We understand you are currently seeking proposals from private architecture firms to design a form-based code in the strategic investment area. Form-based codes make it easier to build without going through a special use permitting process. Under the city's current affordable housing development law, women are only required to provide affordable housing or contribute money to the affordable housing fund when they apply for special use permits. Although the city supports the residents' Bill of Rights for redevelopment, which protects public housing, a A form-based code will lead to less attraction for other affordable housing in the strategic investment area if nothing else is done. The firms will be required to submit proposals showing how they will preserve existing affordable housing and promote new affordable housing development within the strategic investment area. These proposals cannot be a mere formality, and it is your responsibility to make sure that the chosen firm prioritizes the interests of low-income residents. We urge you to, one, prevent another Vinegar Hill by stopping the displacement of Charlottesville's African-American families by examining and implementing alternative policies. Two, make affordable housing and input from low-income residents your top priority for evaluating form-based code proposals. Three, preserve neighborhood integrity. And four, protect and expand affordable housing for low-income people. Signed, you. Audience. Okay, I'm gonna walk the... Do you guys want to shout or do you want me to walk the mic around? Oh, we have a mic. So put your... Raise your hand and Andrew will bring a mic to you. So how about this?
Good evening. I'm curious if there's any research done that will look at whether the various codes, better or worse, meet those goals of community equality, civil rights. That first slide that was presented by Dr. Harris. And secondly, if there are some better codes to meet those goals, do we have any good way of measuring as we go through this process whether we're achieving that goal of opening the community or equality, et cetera? And is this all subject to being totally overridden by the appeals process in Charlottesville, where we see city council often take things that go through the current planning commission and the developer says, well, I'm going to appeal, and then there's this de novo review, and then whatever the developer wants is often approved. So it's outside of the planned zone. There seem to be plenty of loopholes that developers have. I'm curious if there's any way to ensure that those goals are the first slide or not.
So with respect to the first question about comparison, one thing that makes it hard to compare across the country is, like Kim said, states sort of control how zoning works within their state. So outside of Virginia, it's hard to say, really to say it's apples to oranges at a certain point, if you look at a place like Nashville or New Orleans. One, I think the best example we've found of a comparative example to what's going on in the strategic investment area is in Arlington, in the Columbia Pike Revitalization District. They're under the same law that Charlottesville is. And as we said, they've managed to put into place what seems like a, as far as things go, a fairly strong affordable housing protection. So I would encourage people, if they're interested in viewing something that maybe Charlottesville could aspire to look at the Arlington Code. And besides that, I don't think there's anything that really systematic that's been done within Virginia to say. I know Virginia Beach, for example, has a form-based code as well, and a special planning district similar to the strategic investment area. And to my knowledge, it doesn't have any affordable housing protections built in, but I also don't know enough about the situation to compare. And sorry, can you repeat the final two?
Whether the city council authority to override planning decisions by the current planning commission and architectural review board, et cetera, that the council basically can dance over the existing code. And I'm curious if they would have that ability, that if we go through this whole process of coming up with a really workable code, whether it really exists only at the whim of the current city council, if they have the opportunity to override any decision that's made by any of those bodies, the local council.
So the question, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is whether the city council would have an opportunity to override anything that was done in a new code that were implemented possibly with affordable housing protections. So I guess the key, I don't know because it depends on what we come up with in a way, but if an ordinance is passed in its law, and the law says that developers have to provide a certain X amount of affordable housing in certain situations. That's a law that the city council can't change unless it repeals that law. So that once the law is in place, that's what they have to follow, and if they don't follow it, then lawyers can sue to enforce that. So besides that, I don't know if is that correct, or do you want to add anything? Okay. Does that answer your question?
Well, I just would just like to see those protections be guarded, that the developer doesn't say, well, I disagree, I'm going to have a case with the city council and plead my case. Yeah, I just think we need to ensure that those protections are there. Because right now, you have zoning, and the planning commission would say, well, we think that this is inappropriate, yet they get it.
Right.
Hi, thank you very much for your presentation. I kind of feel this is my first real exposure to form-based zoning, and I feel a little bit more confused perhaps after the presentation than I did before. But one thing that caught my eye is that I saw in Nashville, I don't know if these were actual numbers, but the zoning code had gone from 100 pages down to 5. And I'm just wondering, what is the information, some of the information that is not being included that people thought for many years was important to include, and that's why it's 100 pages long, and whether having a 5-page document, it seems to me, can only give the very most rudimentary instructions. But I was wondering if you could just address that.
Sorry, what was the very last thing you said?
I just want to address that, whether that's accurate enough, because it seems like going from 100 pages to 5 pages, there can't really be a lot of
I think it's hard. Have you looked at the Nashville code?
So the Arlington Code of Texas setting is pretty lengthy. I think a better way to think of it is that the codes are simplified in that they're using lay terminology, and I think that there's a lot more visuals. There's not one form-based code that cities are adopting, right? I mean, that's why I was kind of trying to give the common characteristics of form-based code. I think when people say form-based code, what are they generally referring to? So I think the way that people would positively, it's a selling point for form-based code. It's accessible, it uses diagrams, it is it's clear what they want, right? That's the sales pitch
for me. Mm-hmm. For who?
Dr. Harris has said that a lot of folks feel that form-based code is driven by developers sometimes. They prefer to have certainty of knowing if I build this certain thing, it will be approved and I'll be able to build it. What I've heard from reading from those developers is that helps with financing. They can know if I do X, Y, or Z, this project will go forward, and I don't have to deal with an uncertain political process. It may involve NIMBYism or whatever other type of opposition. So that there's some preference for that prescriptive.
Is there a reason to think that developers are being stifled, and that therefore there's a need to have
in Charlottesville?
Yes, more basic.
Well, I'm not so certain that developers are being stifled, but remember this, at least try. When a developer comes forth, his, her, or their primary interest is keeping all costs at a minimum to maximize profits. And I'm not arguing that's a good thing or bad thing. That's just the reality. I don't think in Charlottesville developers are necessarily being stifled or put off. No developer wants to answer questions that they could get done without answering. And form-based codes, to some degree, are designed for that. to me, the greater challenge becomes one of, well, what is this designed to be? We know that New Urbanism primarily focuses upon the aesthetics, and I think that's good. That people would want an ugly development. But the other thing Form-Based Codes does not do very well is to accommodate all income racial groups at a level that I think would bring about greater fairness.